So it's nice to be here. I feel kind of like the crazy aunt in the attic, like that I'm not quite sure how I'm related to everything here, but both Nigel and Eberhard tell me I am, so I'll continue. So before I start, I want to make several acknowledgments. This work, of course, is largely done by graduate students and colleagues, and in particular, Kristen Ringland, Serge LeMay, and Yanping Li, who've all moved on to other places down at the bottom, and acknowledge my funding sources, NSF. So let me begin. And I'll end my talk. I want to, I'm not going to assume that you know what charged density waves are here. Many of you do, but I wasn't sure who I was talking to. And then also I'd like to briefly go over some of the X-ray technology that we use, those, and so on, because later in the talk when we start talking about coherent X-rays, it will become important. And then go through the details of niobium triselenide and charged density waves. What I'm going to try and convince you is, as I think yesterday, Nigel, you said that it takes billions of dollars to get to where you don't understand particle physics and so on, and only dollars to understand what you don't understand, to get to where you don't understand mixing. And, but here we're at an intermediate stage, or maybe you thought we understood something, and apparently we don't. So my goal is to convince you we don't know what we're doing.
Hundreds of millions.
Well, it depends on what you bill me for. The synchrotron, we're getting close to them. So let me begin with the charged density wave. It's a very simple elementary excitation. In the simplest case, consider a one-dimensional metal. And the basic idea, if I've got a very simple energy band structure, is I open a gap in the spectrum at the Fermi level. At t equals zero, the only states which are occupied are down here. So any system can lower its energy, its electronic energy, by opening a gap at the Fermi surface. And the states that move up are unoccupied, so they don't count. The question is, what do you need to do that? Turns out a phonon will do it. And this is the Pyrrhal's instability. So if I have a longitudinal acoustic phonon, it's a one-dimensional density wave, it will create a corresponding charge density wave in the conduction electron density. It turns out that the gain in the elastic, the energy you get from the electronic gain is bigger than the elastic energy required. So if nothing else happens, every one-dimensional metal should have this instability. Okay. And we normally think about it in this form. And so the part I want you to watch is here. This is the distortion of the lattice, the vector field, and this phase variable here, I think, is the connection to the rest of this workshop. So, now one of the intriguing things about charge density waves is you can make them move. And the basic idea is if you think about it like a rigid washboard, and I apply a field to it, I can pull it through the lattice. And the reason this works is because the wave vector of the charge density wave is determined by the Fermi wave number, not by the lattice. So if they're incommensurate, there's no preferred position for the charge density wave, so there's no elastic restoring force. I can have friction due to impurities and so on, but that gives me just a critical field for depinning. So if I apply an electric field to it, I can actually rip this thing loose and it starts moving uniformly. I get nonlinear conduction. And this would be the signature of it. This is the differential resistance. And at low fields, not much is happening. And then at a critical field, the resistance drops dramatically as the nonlinear conduction kicks on. Okay, so now it's just kind of a strange system when you think about it. In some sense, it looks like a sliding crystal. I've got all these wave fronts, just this washboard is moving through. I've got all these pinning sites, all kinds of garbage in there that it runs into, and it starts ringing and doing all kinds of stuff. The question is how does it depin? What happens? What's the structure of the system? And people have been dealing with this for a long time. I didn't invent this field. People were working on this when I was in grade school, literally. And I won't even tell you how old I am. But it starts out at low fields, you're pinned. And the general idea was at very low fields below threshold, you get some thermally activated motion, some creep. At slightly higher fields, there might be some ripping and tearing, and you get some plastic flow. But then at very high fields, after you depin, the effectiveness of these pinning centers are reduced, and you should get a recorrelation, a reordering of the system, and you get into the charge dense wave basically doesn't see the disorder that it's going over anymore. So this is the picture that people thought, or many still believe, is correct, and it may be. I'm not sure. So for charge density waves, it turns out that X-ray scattering is almost an ideal probe at the structure of a charge density wave. For the first reason, it's a non-perturbative probe. The X-rays, as far as we can tell, don't affect the system at all. Second, I can interpret it really directly what's going on, and that this is the structure factor here. And roughly speaking, what you're going to get in the signal is going to look like the Fourier transform of this correlation function here, for which later on I'm going to call it g, the exponential would be the logarithm. And if I had Gaussian statistics, it would just be this height difference function, and which is also similar to things people talk about here. Now, big part of what we do is probably not so interesting to you guys, but it consumes a lot of my life, and that's taking care of synchrotron beam lines and synchrotron sources. And the question is, why do we do this? There's got to be an easier way. Okay? And the answer is there isn't. But these things, we'll get to it in a second. But the basic idea is particle physicists made these machines, and you've got radiating charges, dipole radiation comes out, relativistic effects fold it forward. And so you get these very bright little blips of light every time the electrons go around, and they're highly angularly collimated. We can give them another goose by sending through, instead of one magnet, a whole bunch of magnets. So we have a 50-pole wiggler, and you get about 50 times what you get out of one magnet. But the question is, why do you do this? Why do you put up with this when you can have a machine in your lab? And the basic answer is, at comparable angular resolution and energy resolution, I can get about 10 million photons a second onto my sample in my lab in Clark Hall. If I go over to CHESS, depending on how we set it up, I can get anywhere from 10 to the 12th to 10 to the 15 in the same volume. So if you start scaling things, I have to get a factor of 50% on my rotating anode. I have to double the cost. So NSF is never going to go for that factor of 10 to the 7. So what you get is extraordinarily bright. It's a little bit hard to see. What this is the X-ray beam coming through a tank full of helium. And it's ionizing the helium as it comes through. So that a little bit like with CO2 lasers, so you can see them break down as you go through, and you always, take the chalk dust or something. And you can actually see these things. Now, if it was in the room, it would be blue from nitrogen.
They don't damage your sample.
This is the white beam. And so it's a, by the time I make it monochromatic. There's several kilowatts of power in here. The power density after we focus it is comparable to what's in an electron arc welder. So yeah, that would damage most things. But so this is not your father's X-ray source anymore. So where do we work? Different places. There's Cornell in all its glory. Brookhaven has a source, and Argonne has one. And I'll show you data from all of these sources today. Okay, so niobium triselenide is the prototypic material. Charge density waves here have been known since the 70s, and its structure is shown here. And it's one-dimensional in many aspects. The crystal structure is one-dimensional. You take a niobium atom and then put a little triangle of seleniums and another niobium. You make long chains of these things. And then you grab a bunch of chains together. The conductivity along the chains is about 100 times greater than perpendicular. So it's really one-dimensional in all aspects. It's a little hard to see in this picture here, but it grows one-dimensionally too. You get this stuff, it looks like hair or fuzz. A typical sample will be a few microns thick and maybe 10 microns wide. It's a little bit ribbon-shaped and millimeters or centimeters long. There are a couple charge density waves in it. One, they all form primarily along the B axis, which is the whisker axis, they're not quite commensurate there. Phase transitions around 145 and 59 degrees. Okay, so what's the phase diagram look like? As I cool down and at zero temperature, there's a phase transition. And so if I raise the field, I can depin this Q1 CDW. As I cool down below the next pyrrole's transition, and we get this kind of funny phase diagram here. There are two different regions here, which I'll talk about in the second half of the talk. In reciprocal space, it's if you, let me go back one. If you look at this structure here, you'll notice that adjacent chains are about 90 degrees out of phase, 180 degrees out of phase. And what that does is in the X-ray diffraction, doubles the unit cell effectively, that they're scattering out of phase so that the O10 Bragg peak is actually absent. The charge density wave satellites, however, survive. And so we'll be looking at, there's a charge density wave satellite around every Bragg peak. So and the experiments are done at low temperature, obviously, and we've got to get the X-rays in and out. Since we're going to be passing current through the samples, we've got to be able to get the heat away, and so on. So we have a sample cell design where we have an aluminum substrate with a hole drilled in, about 3 millimeters in diameter. The niobium trisulfide whisker is glued across it, and there are little patterned electrodes that allow us to do four-point electrical measurements. We have a little top hat-shaped piece of beryllium, which comes down over the top, and then we can put helium exchange gas around it to keep it cold. And then that's hooked up either to a closed-cycle helium refrigerator or a helium cryostat. We work in a transmission geometry, so this is basically what you'll see. The lines of constant phase are shown here. The X-rays come in and are scattered out, giving us the momentum transfer, and we can do simultaneous transport measurements. So this is what it looks like in place. This is at the advanced photon source. What you're seeing here is the helium cryostat. And boy, it's hard to see on here. But this is the sample chamber. The X-rays are coming in from the right here. In this particular case, it's actually a CCD camera sitting up here in a slightly different closer-up view here. OK, so now it turns out the main questions here are going to have to do with the behavior of the system as we whack it. All right? And the models, what you're primarily interested in is the response of the system as it goes over random impurities, the pinning sites, and so on. And so first thing you want to do is make sure that you understand your sample. And you want it to behave correctly, it's the only way, in a reproducible fashion. And so one of the things it turns out you don't want is a multi-domain sample, because you get all kinds of scattering at the domain boundaries. If you got a small angle grain boundary or an irregularly shaped sample, that actually affects everything. So one of the measures that people typically use is what's called the mode locking signature. And what they do, you're going to apply an oscillating field, RF field around 10 megahertz, and then sweep the current across. And when the washboard frequency, that's the frequency of every phase front coming by, matches the drive frequency, you'll actually lock in. Okay? And this is interpreted as being a macroscopic velocity-velocity correlation function. The whole system becomes macroscopically organized and is sloshing back and forth together. And so what you see, this is actually a very nice sample. Here's the primary. So here's a zero field in the primary, and you see almost complete mode locking and lots of subharmonics that are quite powerful as well. And so we take this as a surrogate of having a single domain sample. We can actually mode lock the entire sample together. So why is this important? Well, one of the things, remember, we're trying to see is we start driving it, we want to see the recovery of long-range order. That's the prediction. And so in this particular case, here's an example where some X-ray diffraction profiles taken through a charge density wave satellite. And as you crank up the field, you see it first broadens and then sharpens. And here's the half width at half maximum. It's a function of field. And the question, people are saying, hey, we found what prediction's right, theory's good, and everything. Turns out that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. What this particular case is going to turn out to be is a sample that has a couple different thicknesses. To explain that, we did a diffraction topography experiment. The basic idea is if this is my sample, take a great big wide beam, come in, and this whole thing then should be an image of my Bragg peak. If different parts of the sample have slightly different orientations, the intensity will vary across that sample, so I can get an image of the structure from a diffraction image. On the left-hand side is an optical micrograph. And here you can see the shadows that we think the sample actually looks something like that. Okay, and associated with that, there must be a small angle grain boundary in here because the Bragg peak associated with that direction, this is about a tenth of a degree here. There, you can see, so it's a low angle grain boundary there. So if I look at the diffraction image, what happens? If I start out at zero field, I see a very uniform peak or image. Then as these units are in units of the threshold field. So right at threshold, what you see is the left-hand side of the sample moves. So the left-hand side has been depinned and starting to slide. The right-hand side is still holding still. And then as I get to higher and higher drives, I get more and more uniform. So this doesn't have anything to do with recorrelating in the presence of the random field. What this has to do with is the threshold field takes on different values in different thickness samples. Also, I just ripped it in half, and then after it depins, it starts to catch up with itself. So that's not the effect that people were talking about. So let me skip that one. So characterizing the sample, it's absolutely critical to know what you're talking about so you don't get things. Next thing is we're going to try and do time-resolved measurements, where we look at time scales that vary from seconds down close to a microsecond. We got little tiny samples. Remember, there's still only microns across. We don't get much scattering. So we're going to have to do some periodic averaging. And so what we're going to do is a set of experiments where we turn the field on and off and watch this over tens of thousands of cycles. So what you're going to see is time average data. So here's a sample data set. As somebody said, this is probably one of the best we ever took. We've done it at several temperatures, but never got all the graphics to work on everything. It's beautiful. So in this particular case, this is the direction we're going. We're cutting across us, the charge density wave. This direction is time in milliseconds, and scattered intensity. At time t equals zero, we turn the field off. So it's in the sliding state. I turn the field off, and it reorders. All right, and what you see here, this is the peak intensity. Just comes up nice and smooth. And this is the integrated intensity, and this was supposed to be the applied field. Okay, so that's the kind of data we're looking at. Now, where did all this theory come from? There was some trepidation at the Theory Institute, but I'm not going to go through all this stuff. I think lots of very famous people, many of them in this room, spent a lot of time working on this. But the basic model goes back to Fukuyama, Lee, and Rice. And the basic idea is you have an order parameter. Or think back to my earlier definition. There's a phase field, and then this thing looks like an amplitude times e to the ikx. So in the standard models, you treat this part in mean field theory and then study the fluctuations here. And then this is the Hamiltonian that's used to study the fluctuations. And you've got an elastic term. This is the pinning term, and this is the drive term. Okay, so that's too complicated for us to study. So normally what you do is you replace that pinning term with a random field. If I'm only interested in low temperature behavior, so we'll ignore temperature for the time being, and I'm going to look in the limit where the field has been turned off, because that's what I care about. You come up with this rather simple expression, which you can actually solve for this correlation function under the appropriate conditions. And this is what it looks like. So if we can numerically integrate it in three dimensions, and for various times after you turn off the field, you see these different behaviors. There's here. And that's still too difficult for us to analyze the data. There's a lot of stuff in there. So we made a really gross approximation. And this is going to drive most of you crazy, I know. Well, we notice that up here, you've got one slope. Down here, you've got another slope. So we're just going to approximate that correlation function by two different slopes, and this thing marches across in time and with some characteristic power. And the amazing thing is that this is going to work. If I'm under that assumption, I can calculate the time-dependent. Oh boy, I got whipping along. So you get a stretched exponential kinetics here. If I change that and say, okay, I don't really know what that power law is, as what I'm going to get is my initial line shape decays with some power law, final line shape comes up with the same power law. Same data set, so now a two-parameter fit for thousands of time slices works phenomenally well. Okay. Now, what are these values? I get a constant value of mu, that's good. And I get a time constant here which varies over something like 7 decades. Right? And we don't understand that, where that comes from. Okay, but there's something else which has now drove people crazy. If I just look at the width, or the, alternatively 1 over the correlation length, here's a function of time. Remember the prediction was the sliding state should be more ordered. It should have been sharper than the pin state. Okay, what we're finding is, as a function of applied field, the system is still disordering. Now, we're responsible for a certain amount of confusion in the field because we have another data set just like this one, goes out a little farther, and there's a data point which is down about here. And several groups said, that's the recorrelation we're looking for. Or we should have put more error bars on things that I don't think it's real. Let me skip this. So, the basic observation is, as we get above threshold, where you're expecting things to reorder, instead they're disordering. Okay, let me skip this because I really want to talk about the switching behavior in this next regime. So what happens down here? Well, this is the regime that's very similar to that original phase diagram I told you about where you have, thought was you might have activated flow, plastic flow, and then sliding flow. The basic idea is, here's the creep, there's a plastic region, and you jump to the fast branch and come back and forth. There's some very interesting measurements came out. This is the work of Serge Lemay. What he did, he put these very low currents on, and then he looked at what's called the narrow band noise. What this is the washboard frequency for these very low currents. So we're down in this region here, which is supposed to be the plastic flow region, where all the ripping and tearing is going on. What you see is a very coherent collective response. So we're getting washboard-like flow in the region where the prediction was plastic flow. Okay. So we want to go check this out with x-rays. The basic idea now is we're going to use coherent x-rays, is where the whole illuminated spot size is coherently illuminated, and so I can see the disorder. We're going to see speckle like in a laser system, and so we can just now do this at the advanced photon source. We have a coherent enough source. What you're looking at here is one Bragg peak. Okay, this light and dark business here is a piece of film. These are the actual speckles, and so these are fluctuations as the go from 0 to 1. Here's the same similar image. Edge on the CCD camera, and then there's a line through here, and you can see what it looks like. And these fluctuations turn out to be huge compared to counting statistics. Okay, and what happens when we pull the apply the field is you start up here, zero field. Near threshold starts to broaden, and double threshold is quite broad here. Okay, so that's similar to what we saw in the conventional scattering. But now we can do the autocorrelation function measurement. What we're going to do is pixel by pixel, or speckle by speckle, we measure its intensity at time 0 and at time t, a average over in the usual form. So you do this in visible light all the time. But this is now at one Q point, finite Q, away from the zone. What we find then is something which is really quite bizarre. It's not what we expected to find. In this region down here, we see a static speckle pattern. Nothing's moving. Up here, it's all washed out. We don't see any autocorrelation function. It's all smeared out. But in here, we see static speckle. So now we've got a real conundrum. This is where plastic flow was supposed to be happening. This is the ripping and tearing. But it's not ripping and tearing. It's staying completely. We can't find any motion. And it's only very near here where we actually see a correlation function. Now you gotta be careful. We're signal limited, and we tuned all the parameters to where we could see a time constant where we could measure it. So whether or not it's moving or not, and here's a little tricky. There's some experiment or bias here. We changed all the parameters so we found the time constant we could measure. But we still got this situation where it looks like the phase diagram is backwards. Where instead of seeing creep, plastic flow, and a moving solid, we're seeing something you might call it an adiabatic flow, where the phase winds up the same everywhere, but it slides through. Oh, and up here, we're seeing the plastic flow. Okay, so what do we do? Now, there's a couple things, models that, well, they were new the first time I gave this talk, they're not so new anymore. All right, amplitude fluctuations are going to be important here. We're ripping and tearing and doing stuff. And if you notice, that whole Fukuyama-Lee Rice formalism doesn't have amplitude fluctuations. So they're important. It's also possible that elastic interactions are not going to be sufficient. We may need a viscoelastic coupling. And we've got to get better data. We need to improve the X-ray photon correlation spectroscopy measurements. And due to long, sad stories about failures of helium suppliers and so on, we haven't been able to finish this experiment despite many attempts. And the next is, there's a fundamental problem nobody called me on here. The X-ray scattering, you measure the positions of the core electrons. In all the transport measurements, you're measuring the conduction electron density. Okay, there's another null experiment that if I do these diffraction measurements during mode locking, there's no structural signature of mode locking. So you see this dramatic, beautiful effect in the transport, the recorrelation and so on. If you're doing the diffraction experiment, you cannot tell you've mode locked. So the question is, have we decoupled the conduction electron density from the lattice? So let me go through these quickly. This is Marchetti's group's proposed. That was one model where she actually has a viscoelastic coupling. The predicted phase diagram is similar. We haven't had a chance to test that. Our buddy Martin Grant has another model that he calls the modified Swift-Hohenberg equation. And it drove him crazy that there was no, in the Fukuyama-Lee Rice model, there are no ripples. And he said, how can you have a charge density wave model with no charge density wave in it? And so they created one. And so the basic idea here is by putting this extra little term in here, that keeps it pointed in the direction you want, so on. In their simulations, they get a threshold field, and what happens is you start ripping and tearing and making defects. And this is the number density of the dislocations, which rises and falls above threshold. Oh, and so this is where I got into trouble. I was like, Joel, you told me that it falls. This is great. And I said, well, Martin, it doesn't really fall. So we have a little disagreement about what the data says. So that's another possibility where to go. And finally, it might be a problem with the experiment that we're looking at the wrong thing. It's the conduction electrons you expect to reform. And so one of the things we're working on next week at CHESS is a resonant diffraction experiment where the idea is, I drew this wrong, but you're going to come in and near an absorption edge excite the electron up to the conduction band density where the density of states diverges because you've got the gap. And that gives you a resonant enhancement of the signal. It also, if you use the dipole coupling, so this should be L to D, we need the L edge so we can get to the right band, but that'll flip the polarization. So then I can do a polarization analysis, squash all the normal charge scattering, and just see what happens at the charge density wave. Maybe. Okay. So that's about where we are right now. And so this is the group. Can you tell who stayed up all night in this group? This was at the end of the first one. So the graduate student there is Yanping Li. This is Rob Thorne, who actually grows the samples and does all the transport. Mark Sutton built the beamline and is best friends with Martin Grant. We got hooked up. And I'll quit here a minute early. Thanks. And now I'm in trouble.
So I had a quick question. Halfway through your talk, I was thinking you should be using the Hohenberg-Swift equation, and you showed the modern grants theory. Mm-hmm. But one thing about that, is that gauge invariant, the full model that they wrote down?
I don't know. Okay. We should check that, right?
Right. There might be a way to fix up the model.
You noticed probably when during your talk that we were talking and smiling, Nigel and myself, because when we had the workshop here, the program on pattern formation, there was parallel program about charge density wave, and there was a lot of work in parallel, and we were studying Swift-Homberg equation at that time, and also being involved to some extent with charge density wave. And I wanted to ask you if you tried to add to the DC current and AC current, because at that time there is a paper by John Bardeen, myself, and two experimentalists that we suggested that because of the nonlinearity and the fact that it can be described better in this manner, if you add an AC current on top of the DC, then it might help you to see internal mode locking and to probe better into the dynamic.
You can do the mode locking either way. You can either sweep the AC frequency or the DC field. Both work. So,
yeah. Why? Just my question. Why do you still using this? Is it still popular in the field? I don't feel the field to use the Fukuyama Lee Rice model. And what happened with the Bardeen picture that of this
Marcos? I think
as far as I know, nobody ever picked it up. That. Right, right. I don't think that ever found any customers. All right.
Any other questions? Is there any possibility to get at the local phase? You know, instead of illuminating the whole thing, can you actually get more local information?
Yes. That we've done some in the Grenoble group has done some. We take a very small spot, and in particular, trying to see what happens near the contacts. So it's a question of what do you mean by local? That we can get.
I mean local on the scale of the sample.
Right. Yeah, and what you see is that there's actually a parabolic phase distribution across. That, if you think about it, the contacts are very interesting. If the charge density wave starts sliding, they're pinned in the contact. As it starts sliding, you're basically straining it, and you need to nucleate a dislocation loop open. So you've got under tensile strain here, and you get to the other side, you're squashing them up, and you get compressive strain. And so we see that in the phase profile across and so on. So that part we can do. And on a local scale, you can also see the Fredel oscillations around individual pinning sites. And some people have been looking at that as well.
You introduced the model that effectively it's one strand. Do you know if people try to do also multiple strands and introduce coupling across the quasi one-dimensional strand and see how this will affect the coherence? Because there were arguments, I remember at the time, if this cross coupling should be like cosine of phi or what, or should be linear.
Various things have been done, and it's certainly true that the transverse correlation, the elastic constants, it's highly anisotropic. And so that's in here.
And this can give you a nonlinear effect in the perpendicular direction.
Yeah, there is an effect where you lose disorder more rapidly transverse. The power law is different due to what you're talking about here. It's highly model dependent, and the data actually doesn't warrant a lot more detailed analysis. It's also not going to get a lot better. And those were log plots, so that. You know, we're talking about diffraction intensities over five decades, and it's just barely coming out of the noise. And
And do you know if people try to squeeze it even mechanically in the perpendicular?
Yeah.
And
does it have
an effect?
Bent it, and so on.
And it has an effect on the correlations?
On the transport, we haven't done it. It's hard to separate the correlations because you also strain the bulk crystal, and so you get a broadening. So I can't. I need a real microprobe then to look at one volume. So I can't see it.
Other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. Let's continue.